This is Dudley Jeehan, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 7th of July, 2012.
My name is Dudley Jeehan. I was born in the island of Guernsey, Channel Islands, in 1938, 23rd of November, making me a Sagittarian.
And you're now how old?
I'm now in my 74th year.
Okay. So Jeehan is a Guernsey name?
It's a French, a Norman French name. Claim to fame, there is a knight, Jehan, in Saint-Malo. And there is a Saint Jehan, who is a saint of fishermen in some obscure cathedral. His name escapes me. And in Caen, the Abbaye des Hommes, which is a very famous Catholic cathedral, Dom Jehan in 1604 renovated it. Painter and decorator, I guess, you know, did a bit of a job. So, yeah, steeped in French, really. Although I have been told by a very learned lady that we probably came from the Mongols. And I did visit China and look over the top into... what's the country?
Mongolia.
Mongolia, thank you very much. There we are, the memory, you see. And I thought, yeah, that's where I came from. I rode with the hordes pillaging and raping across Europe, finished up in Guernsey. What a charming place to finish up.
Interestingly, there's a Jerseyman here this weekend. I'll introduce you later on.
Now, you do know the relationship
with
the Jerseyman.
I'll expect fisticuffs.
That's sport the whole weekend for me.
Okay. Right. Well, he lives in Australia now.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. What was your education like on Guernsey?
Very good. Did I take advantage of it? Question. We still have an 11 plus system and grammar schools. Can you believe it? I was fortunate enough to win a scholarship to Elizabeth College, which was a public school on Ireland, which dates back to Elizabeth I. Very, very well known. I mean, no, it's not in the top 50, but it's a very well known and respected place. And that was my education, which, like so many young men, I wasted and left it. I did my O-levels, but left before A-levels. And there were peers of mine going to passing scholarships to Oxford and Cambridge and all the rest. I had no feel for that at all.
So you took a job instead, did you?
I took a job. And
in what?
Well, the first job I applied... On Guernsey in those days, you didn't apply for jobs in the press. Your dad, your father, who would know lots of people, would say, "What would you like to do, son?" I said, "I'm not really sure." He said, "I've got a friend who's a lawyer. I'll take you along." So we went to this legal practice, and I can recall sitting in a waiting room with my father for the interview. And it was dark. There was a little window. And there was a clock on the wall with a pendulum. Clock, clock. And after about 20 minutes, I said, "Dad, I'm sorry. I can't do this." Which embarrassed him a bit, so he apologised to his friend, the lawyer, and that was it. I joined the Met Office in Guernsey.
Oh, right.
And that was wonderful. That suited me. You know, I had a bit of a scientific background and joined the Met Office, went to London to train, worked at the old Heathrow Airport for some years, back to Guernsey. And lo and behold, one day reading the Weather magazine, imagine the monthly, you know, and there was Falkland Island Dependencies Survey application for job application.
What did you know about Antarctica at that point in your life? Had you read about it?
Yes. Yeah.
What?
This sounds a little contrived, but believe me, it's not. My mum, who was born in 1906, went to school until the age of 13, which was usual in those times, left school and went into service. But she loved history and studied history, and she won a prize, a school prize. And it was the first recording of Scott's polar expedition. And that was in my home all my life. And I used to read that assiduously. We had a number of encyclopedias as well, but Scott of the Antarctic, I read it, I loved it. And then, of course, as a young man growing up, thought nothing more about it. Until this came up, I thought, wow, Antarctica, wow, that seemed a bit forbidding. Step too far, totally, I think. I'll give it a go. And there we are.
What was the interview like?
It was pretty it was pretty uncomfortable because it was quite plain that I didn't have the necessary educational qualifications. I mean, they were looking for guys. I applied for a job as a meteorologist, and they weren't particularly looking for trained meteorologists. They wanted scientists, guys with science degrees, maths degrees, geography, whatever. And so, of course, Dudley goes along with his O-levels. And I later learned through Bill Sloman, who was the HR director, I guess. That was his role, who interviewed me. And, of course, later in my career, I reached a fairly prominent position in Bass, you might say. Got to know Bill quite well. And he spoke to me off the record and said, Sir Vivian said, we can't take this guy. Got an interesting background, we can't take this guy. He hasn't got the necessary qualifications. And by all accounts, Bill Sloman and it could have been Eric Samelang. Anyway, two of them stood up for me. I had two interviews. I might have even had more. And I really didn't think that I would be accepted, but I was. And, I had a very frosty relationship with Sir Vivian at first. But then, time went on, and in 5 years later, I was base commander at Halley, and he was very different towards me after that. I got to know him very well through Maurice Sumner. And in his late years, Maurice and I used to go to his flat in behind Harrods when he lived there with Eleanor. And we'd go to the Bass reunions in London, and we'd go and collect him, Maurice and I. And it was great because I got to know him. He would treat me as an equal. But I do recall at the beginning that there was the feeling, I shouldn't be here. Mm. I ain't good enough, but I'll show these guys.
Do you think that was counter psychology from Fuchs, that if he gave you a rough time, you might...
No, because he didn't expose that. And, I mean, this came from Bill Sloman. Bill hadn't told me, I would never have known. Although it didn't surprise me, at all.
Yeah.
One of those things.
What did he make of Fuchs generally?
An academic. I'd be very interested to talk to people who were on an expedition with him. I have no first-hand knowledge, but he doesn't strike me as the sort of hands-on guy. And you might say no reason that he should be. But when I think of some of the characters and talking with a colleague over a glass of wine last night, there were some very bright academics, as we know. And I think it's probably fair to say that Halley has a concentration of scientific brain. But there were always half a dozen guys who made the whole thing work and kept it going and put their legs back on the table when it fell off and kept the generators running. And, and maybe because I'm that sort of person, I tend to focus on that. That was my real satisfaction out of my involvement.
As a professional meteorologist, was being a Met Man at Argentine Islands in 1960 a bit of a doddle then?
Yeah, I made a mistake a few weeks ago where a gentleman, Alan, who's organised this interview for me, and we've spoken on the phone a number of times, and in conversation I said, Base F holiday camp, very pretty, but nothing happens, Thank you very much, he said. I spent 2 years there.
Well, he was a holiday camp cook.
Yes, he was indeed. And there's no doubt, it is the most beautiful bit of Antarctica I've ever seen. But after a year, it didn't pall exactly, but I wanted to do something different. And I was serving with Maurice Sumner, who is a very well-known character in Bass. He and I as Met Men. And I think we made the decision together, let's get out of here. And there was an offer to go to Halley. And all the research that we were able to do and the conversations, everyone talked about Halley as being the end of the end of the earth. Oh my God, underground. I referred to people at Halley as troglodytes, 120 days without sun, low temperatures. What a place to be. Imagine you could be in Argentine Islands looking at those magnificent mountains. Let's have a go at that. And, wow.
Better or worse?
That was the experience of my life. Because of the challenges. There wasn't a day, there wasn't a challenge. And in preparation for this interview, because frankly my concern about this interview has been the memory's fading a bit. Some people recall easily, I don't necessarily. So I read all the base journals I could. Base F, holiday camp, my life consisted of meth, eating, doing a bit of skiing, going for the odd trip with the dogs for a mile or two and back to base, and always comments about the weather wasn't good enough to ski and to go and sunbathe or whatever. Literally that, you know. And then I read the base journals of Halley. And the contrast is just phenomenal. There wasn't a day without there wasn't something happening of some consequence. A lot of it was the Jennies have stopped working again, and I got very involved with the diesel mech, supporting and helping him because, you know, I was a bit of a mechanic. But there was always something going on.
Was that because there were more people?
No. I mean, base F, there were 12. So there were three times as many on Halley.
Yeah.
No, it was the nature of the place. I mean, it took so much more maintenance to maintain. I was mentioning to a colleague last night that in the three winters at Halley, we in the second and third year, we built a new base hut with living accommodation up on the surface. And I never, ever lived in that. I chose to live in the old one, which was 50 foot below the ground. And I had a... I guess, as base leader, I could choose to do what I wanted within reason. And I had a room which is sort of twice the size of this this hotel room we're in, and under this roof that every month it would another rafter, another joist would crack and break, and the ice was pushing the thing down. Sorry, how did I get there? Why was it so busy? One, you had this massive scientific program. Then, of course, the field program, which in a way Alan, Dad Etchells and I started because we were delivered these two wonderful new tractors, these Canadian things, and told go up under the polar plateau and establish a base in the mountains so that lots of surveyors and geologists and clever people can follow you. So off Dad and I set.
I mean, technically you're a meteorologist, but you're now suddenly becoming a tractor maintenance expert.
I mean, the one thing you realise when you join FIDS, well, I did, this is being a meteorologist was the means of getting the job.
Yeah.
But you realise straight away, I don't want to do that all the time. Anyone can do that.
It's repetitive, is it?
Yeah. I mean, I want to drive dogs, which I didn't want to do, drive tractors, climb mountains, do whatever. And therefore, as quickly as I could, I moved out into what's called a GA, I think, as you may be aware, General Assistant. And on my second tour, I recall that I was called to Millbank and I was interviewed because I applied for a job as a tractor mechanic. And this guy, who was an engineer, I guess, interviewed me. Now, I've never learned a trade. I've tinkered with cars, I've repaired cars and whatever. And for some reason, I got through it. And the next thing I knew, I was called a tractor driver mechanic, which was great.
And base leader?
Oh, that was the fourth year.
Oh, right.
So the third year I went down as a tractor driver.
Yeah.
I led a little expedition to the Totten Mountains. That's when I first met Dad.
Dad Etchells. Then he came home for a while.
I don't know. When I met Dad, I spent 2 years with him. I'd been home before.
Oh, right.
Base F, Argentine Islands. Back home for a summer in Guernsey. Wow. How about that? Then down to Halley Bay for 2 years, and Dad Etchells we worked together the whole of that time. The base leader prior to me was Morris Sumner, and Morris appointed me.
So just so I got this absolutely right, you were not in Halley Bay in 61 then, that was?
Yes, 1960 base F, transferred to Halley 61.
Came home.
Yes, 62, okay, 63, 64.
Right, okay, thank you for that. Yeah. So at what point did you pick up this nickname, Cuddles?
Right from the beginning. I mean, what is this Cuddly Dudley was a character, I don't know whether it was a sort of a film character or whatever, but people invariably, and even today, occasionally, you know, someone will say, we'll use that sort of term, Cuddly Dudley.
Well, Dudley Moore got nicknamed that, didn't he? The musician.
Yeah, then of course I was named Cuddly Dudley long before that.
Yeah.
May I just mention a claim to fame?
Yes, please.
It's interesting how many times in the short while we've been talking, we've mentioned Alan Etchell's dad, who I work with. I named him that. we're working together in the tractor shed or whatever, and I realise he's 11 years older than me. I was 26 at the time, so it's a big difference, isn't it? He was half again as old as me. Mm. And, of course, I started teasing him. You're old enough to be my dad. And it cottoned on. And that's how he became known as Dad.
Right. Yes. And what do you make of him otherwise?
God, what do I make of Dad Etchells? One of the strongest characters I've ever met. A remarkable character.
In adversity?
Oh, he's the man to be with. Mm. Thank you very much. I mean, his skill as an engineer is remarkable. And again, we've been talking recently that I take my car into a garage today and there's electronic testing equipment and whatever. When things broke and went wrong, the first thing you did was to say, we haven't got a part for that, we'll have to make one. You know, we'll have to weld this or, you know, get a big hammer and give that a whack. No, he was a true natural engineer. Quite remarkable. And to work on tractors and vehicles in, you know, minus 50 temperatures, by heck, it's hard. It's tough.
I've been sent a selection of the reports from your era at Hallin. Quite a lot of the time it's talking about comparing the performance of one kind of vehicle to another. Comparing the performance of one kind of vehicle to another,
yes.
Eliassons and Muskegs.
Yeah.
So can we talk a bit about tractive effort then?
Right.
You seem to spend an awful long time trying to wreck Eliassons and Muskegs.
No, quite the reverse. They fell apart and needed a massive amount of maintenance to get... they really weren't fit for purpose. These vehicles were delivered to Antarctica, totally unfit for purpose. I mean, the Muskeg tractor, it's used all over Canada. It's a towing vehicle. It's a... I don't know what, actually, but it's a track vehicle that's used for all sorts of stuff. I understand, I haven't seen them, but they use them in Switzerland in the ski resorts, whatever, which is great. But the moment you put them in a polar environment, up on the polar plateau with ice, sastrugi, it's designed to break things apart. So we spent much of our time, led by Al and other engineers, literally not only putting them back together, but redesigning design faults.
Can you give an example of that?
Yeah, the first trip Al and I did with our new tractors, I mean, they looked as if they'd just come out the showroom, all glossy and shiny with, you know, British Antarctic Survey on them, and off we go. And within, I don't know, within 2 or 3 hours, we realised it was a major problem because the cooling system was dragging snow into the engine compartment that was packing solid to the point where the engine stopped, so it couldn't get any air. And everything was freezing. Now, here's a vehicle that was designed in Canada and used in snowy conditions, and it didn't work. And the first thing that Dad did was to say, well, there are 6 blades on that fan, cooling fan. We'll take 3 off. That helped it a bit. Then we eventually reversed it. We did all sorts of things. That's an example. Batteries don't charge. Why don't the batteries charge? Because they're always frozen at the bottom. So... Dad made up little hot water containers run off the engine that the battery sat in, so the battery was kept warm. Now, okay, pretty fundamental, but that had never occurred to Bombardier, who designed these things for use, presumably, in the cold north of Canada. Those are just a few examples of things that were just not fit for purpose.
And were the Eliassons even worse? Or were they
better? Oh, yeah, they were a disaster. Then, I mean, I don't know the history of motor toboggans, but they were pretty early. I mean, for example, they had a little petrol engine called a Briggs & Stratton, and they're used for pump engines, pumping water from wells, concrete mixers. You know, it's a little commercial engine that does anything, you know, totally unsuitable. And that was cobbled together with all bits of angle iron and whatever, and produced in some factory, and all it did was shake itself apart. But they were great fun to play with. And, you know, they'd tow us along on skis, you see.
There's one, this is 1963, when you took two Eliassons and two Muskegs off together. You had a one called Willis, or Wills.
That was mine, number four,
Wills. Yeah. But how did they get their names? Sadie, Clem, Stancombe and Wills.
Stancombe Wills, Stancombe Wills Promontory was a prominent geographical area near Halley. And they were sponsors of Shackleton, I think.
Oh, I see.
And hence the name. Sadie and...
Clem.
Ah, right. Sadie and Clem were lived in the Falkland Islands. Clem was a radio operator who became a manager, let's call him, a senior manager of FIDS based in Port Stanley. And his wife was Sadie. Got to know them very well. So we named them after Sadie and Clem.
So you, in fact, were named these things?
Yes.
The report that I've got here compares the Muskegs with the Eliassons, and clearly the Muskegs were much more powerful creatures. So
who wrote the report, may I ask?
Well, the answer is you did.
Yes. I did what?
Write the report.
Yes.
So the Muskegs would manage 2.5 tonnes, and the Eliassons only 1,400 pounds.
Yes. Well, I mean, my first reaction is that was a very naive comparison. I shouldn't have even... That's trying to compare a motorbike with a, you know, with a 5-ton truck.
Yeah.
So that really was that was a little spurious, really. But okay, they were sent to us as a possible means of fast transport, pulling sledges that would be maybe akin to those pulled by a dog team. In other words, one Eliasson could be equal to 9 Huskies, and you don't have to feed it other than petrol.
So they were husky power rather than horsepower.
Yeah. But then we know that Scott tried that, didn't he?
Yeah.
And we know how far that got. And I think, you know, he got about 100 yards and realised the thing didn't work and was never going to work.
Well, one of these broke down within 200 yards of the start of the trip.
Yep.
The Muskeg number 3 with a carburettor icing up.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, it says here the Kegs in third gear found it difficult to keep up with the Eliassons. So yes. The Eliassons must have been much faster.
Oh, yes. Yeah, mind you, they weren't pulling heavy loads.
Yeah.
You can put as big a load as you know, you can put a load of a particular size behind an Eliasson and it won't go anywhere. Its speed over the ground is nil, which is sort of true of any tractor unit, isn't it? So I guess that on that occasion we were using them with very light loads. And yeah, they were very nippy. One thing I do recall, we would ski behind them, as I mentioned, on a long line. And the theory was that you set the throttle and if anything went wrong, you had to hold the throttle in place, which we did with a long nylon line. Could be about 30, 40 feet long. So you're skiing behind it and you keep hold of this line that keeps the throttle open. And if anything goes wrong, you release the tension on it and the throttle is then meant to switch off. It has automatic transmission, so it stops. Only it doesn't because it freezes, and it freezes on. And if you happen to fall off your skis, then you see an Eliasson going away in the distance. But one thing that, one of the characteristics, which I think was done deliberately, I don't recall how it works, but if you left it alone without attention, it would actually ride around in a big circle and eventually run out of fuel so you catch it, you know. But that, you know, the naivety of these vehicles was quite...
So you wouldn't actually sit on the machine?
You could do, but we use them as tractors.
Right.
Yeah. A comparison, 4 years ago I took my two grandchildren to Lapland to see Father Christmas. Now there's a story. And having got them to bed one evening, I went on a skidoo.
Yes.
Moonlight through the forest. And this thing had a 500cc engine. And it was phenomenal, the acceleration on this thing. And when the difference in, 30, 35 years between what we had there. And I understand the guys have these vehicles now.
There are skidoos in the Antarctic.
Oh, they're remarkable things.
Yeah. I was going to come to this later, but you kind of preempted it. The year after you left Halley, which is 65, there was that accident in which Wilde, Bailey and Wilson went down a crevasse in a Muskeg.
Yes.
And at that time, Bass was criticised for the way that men would ride the machines without anything probing ahead.
Yes.
What were you doing in your day? Were you doing that as well? Or were you having... Did you always have dogs in front?
No. Right, so let's start with the first occasion, I think, that anyone from Halley had driven the tractor over the... Halley Bay is, some people will be aware, sorry, I'm talking riddles here. Halley Bay is built on an ice shelf, yeah, some 600 feet thick, and therefore it rises and falls with the tide, 2 feet, something in that order. So there's a hinge, a junction between the main polar plateau and the ice, and that bit, of course, is broken up full of holes, and we had to cross that to get up onto the polar plateau. That was a horrendous area. We called it the Bob Pye Crossing, God knows why. I don't know who named it that. So that was our first experience. We left base for the first time. Off we go in these shiny new tractors, 30 miles across fairly flat sea ice, and it was great. And then we came to this area. We had no clues, no idea, no experience. And on the first occasion we went, Dad's tractor go down a hole. And we spent, I don't know, days digging the thing out and pulling it out and winching and whatever. So we learned from that. And
what did you learn from that?
Well, we learned from that, actually, some of the things that are the most dangerous you can't see.
Mm.
Crevasses bridge over because of the continual blowing of the wind and I'm not a glaciologist, the nature of glaciology. You actually get a bridge forming over a crevasse. The crevasse could be up to, I think there is a theoretical maximum width and depth, sort of laminar flow stuff, but it's going to be 12 or 15 feet wide, or could be. And the bridge will build, which, and you can't see me, using my hands, the bridge will build, which may be, I'm using old money, 12, 18 inches thick. And it could well support a man, and it might even support a tractor. Now, in bad light conditions, you can't see these things. In good light conditions, with the sun shining, there is invariably an indentation that if you look carefully enough, and sometimes you can approach an area and say, look at that crevasse area, and you'll see a whole series of indents. And you say, wow. Either we find another way, or one guy, and I was reminded by Dad, again, over the glass of wine last night, you were the first one who got a guy out on a rope, 100 feet of rope, nylon rope, on his skis with a pole probing in front. And at first we thought, wow, there's a load of rubbish, isn't it? You know, we're not going to get anywhere. But it helped avoid that situation.
So in 64 you were using that tactic wherever you felt there was a danger?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Now, I don't know the circumstances of the three poor guys, but I believe, and this is purely word of mouth, that they were probably travelling in conditions in which they shouldn't have been travelling. And by that I mean light.
Mm. They were also off course.
Right, but that didn't matter. So what's on course, what's off course? You know, it's not like being off on the side of a motorway, because there isn't a motorway. The place you are is no better than that place over there.
Mm.
Might even be worse. Light is absolutely critical. And a condition which is well known by people who are familiar with polar regions is called whiteout, where you have a total cloud cover and the light is obviously sort of percolating through it, and you have no horizon. And in the most extreme cases, and I've experienced it as many of all my colleagues would have, you could actually stand and you couldn't see any horizon, and as you started walking, you'd actually start falling over because you had no reference point. And the first time I really realised this was some 15 years ago. I took up flying and got my pilot's licence. And when this guy, the instructor, explained to me the importance of the horizon, I said, you don't need to tell me that, because I've been in Antarctica, and I know that if you can't see, if you have no reference, no shadow, then you've got real problems, because you don't know whether you're on your head or on your feet, to put it bluntly. And I believe that could have been certainly one of the causes.
So in your day, in terms of the protocol for your day would be that it's okay for men to be on tractors in areas known to be clear of crevasses.
Yeah.
But anything unfamiliar, you'd have a man out in front. Or is that too
simplistic? You would need a pretty clear indication that there was problems in the area, that there were crevasses. And either that would be visually, or I guess in some cases, you see, on the edge of this disturbance, there'd be some small crevasses.
Yeah.
You say, oh, hang on, we're breaking through a little... Look out, guys. Mm. It appears to be in that direction, and it's going to get worse.
So when you, as you inevitably would have done, heard about the 1965 loss, the crevasse tragedy, what was going through your mind when you heard that news?
I know the moment precisely. I was on the Kistadan on the way back. And of course, I was the base leader prior year. They were out in the field when I left.
They'd already gone, had they?
Yes, they'd gone. In fact, they were out in the field over the period in which we relieved the base. I guess I can say this, but a period, just a short story to get the context of it. Over a period of a week is the period in which the base is relieved. A ship comes in and thousands of tons of stuff is unloaded. And during that week, if the wind blows, the ship goes, and you're left with all this stuff on the ark. You probably experienced it. And for a base leader, that is the most intense time. I didn't sleep for a week. And that was because Gordon, our doctor, helped me with, I think they were called benzenarine tablets.
Uppers.
And I'd never experienced it before, but I guess you could say I kept awake for most of that week. Excuse me. So having got on board the ship, I gonked out, crashed out for, I think, 2 or 3 days. Mm. And I can recall someone coming, I don't know who, and saying, we just heard on the radio this has happened. My first thought was, probably selfishly, oh my God, I'm glad I'm not the base leader. You know, I thought of Phil Cotton, which was maybe a slightly selfish way of thinking.
But you would have been the base leader who actually sanctioned the trip.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I did.
So was there any kind of sense of guilt at all there?
Not
necessarily justified guilt, but...
Do you know, that has never occurred to me. I'm sorry, that sounds... that may sound very strange, but that never occurs to me. Now, why? Because they left within my period of tenure. But in fact, the idea, OK, off you go, guys, I'll be home in a month's time. We're handing you over to someone else. And in my mind, they were gone. They were handed over to the next base leader, the next group of guys in the next year. So it had never occurred to me before.
I'm not suggesting you should at all.
Oh, no.
And
indeed,
in fact, to go back, what I understand from other interviews is that they were, of course, they thought they were going through a safe area.
Yes.
And they strayed into a crevasse area and were not expecting to be there.
No.
But you knew David Wilde in particular, didn't you?
Yes, I did, yeah. Do you know, one of the things that I was... in my last year as base leader, I didn't leave the base. I didn't travel because, I could have done, I guess, but my role was there, you know. And I was always preaching to these guys about the importance of, if the light goes, if the weather is not right, stop, whatever. And I know that the guys used to say, oh, you're always on about, you know. You're always safety-minded, you're always safety-conscious. But... This was a mantra of mine, and when I was travelling, you know, what is the point of risking yourself? Because you're not only risking yourself, you're risking everyone else. We had a guy who I won't identify, who was an extremely tough guy, paratrooper, free fall, parachuting, all this sort of stuff. And he was an absolute liability to us because he had no sense of danger. And he'd jump out of his tractor. We'd be in crevassed areas. He'd jump out of his tractor. He'd go wandering off and say, for God's sake, come back. If you're going to do that, put a rope on. If you fall down a hole, we got to spend our time getting you out. And he would say, oh, don't worry about that sort of thing, you know. I've always been, am I cautious?
Well, it sounds like you were health and safety conscious before health and safety was invented.
I mean, that sounds dreadful. I'm going to deny that. I'm going to deny having anything to do with health and safety. I think it's about survival. It's not about health and safety. And, you know, in later life, I was a yachtsman for many years, and the same on board boat with my family and friends, whatever. Clip yourself on, tie yourself on. You're no good to anyone if you fall over the side. And I've always had that sort of survival. It's survival instinct, actually. It's not health and safety. Because today's health and safety is meant to be about safety and survival, but it's gone over the top, isn't it? I hope I wasn't too much. But the first thought that came to my mind when I had that news, and I woke quite groggy, and I guess it took me a while to actually absorb it, really. My first thought was, I bet they've been travelling in conditions where they shouldn't have.
Was there also a sense of there, but for the grace of God, go I? Because you mentioned one or two close calls, near things in your trip.
I don't know. I don't know if I thought that.
What were your near calls, your near things? This is in 63.
Well, similar things to that. Like that.
Crevasse.
Yeah, crevasses.
Brushes.
I mean, that was all... Well, that's what it was mainly about. But, you know, there was always, again, the cautious person, I suppose, but always in the back of your mind that a vehicle breaks down, or both of them break down, and you are, you know, 200 miles from base. You can't sort of call the AA out, can you? And you're totally reliant upon getting it fixed. Mm. And on one occasion, I can't recall the date, but coming back from the mountains, two tractors, Alan and me, empty loads, coming back fast as 10 knots, 15 knots, that's fast, wow. And the wheel bearing started seizing on our tractors because they hadn't been prepared properly in the factory. And we could see ourselves in a position where we'd have to abandon a vehicle and limp home with one. And it was getting near the end of the season, i.e. autumn. And the thoughts go through your mind, what happens if we, you know, if this thing breaks, stops? You have to rely upon someone coming from the base with another vehicle, and they have to cross the crevasse area, come and... There was these thoughts all the time of...
Conclusion by D.G. Ham. Autumn journeys of this size are not to be recommended.
I think I recall what that refers to.
In future, unless everything is prepared before the ship arrives.
Yeah.
In fact, you had to prepare after the ship had gone, and you didn't leave till 4 weeks after the ship had gone.
Yes, and it was too late from a weather point of view.
Yeah.
That was, I mean, some of the naivety, frankly. Ignorance. No, I'll use that word. Yeah. We were ignorant. We just didn't understand. And one of the gripes that I have against the British Antarctic Survey, and I've expressed it in a number of reports, there was a whole load of experience before us. The obvious was transantarctic expedition, who crossed the Antarctic with snowcats. The leader of that expedion was Sir Vivian Fuchs, who was also the director of British Antarctic Survey, whatever. You would think that they would have shared reports, knowledge, experience with us. And we asked and asked, never got anything. Almost as if you must reinvent the wheel yourself.
You say in your farewell report, 1964...
Oh, I didn't realise I'd written one of those.
Well, general report for the 64
season. Oh, right, yes, okay.
Couldn't selected reports be exchanged between bases so share the experiences gained? One wonders how often a base has struggled with problems which have already been experienced and overcome by other bases. The amount of time wasted because of these incidents must be considerable. So basically you're suggesting that BAS should make all base reports available to future base leaders.
I'm not aware they've ever done so.
It never happened?
No.
You also suggested that people coming south should read base reports,
yes,
of the base they're going to before, yes, they arrive.
Yes.
Has that ever happened?
Not that I'm aware of.
It's not rocket science, is it?
No.
Was this a big frustration?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yeah, great frustration. But the stupidity of it, I mean, you know, in the last 30 years of my life, almost 40, I've run companies, a whole series of companies doing all sorts of stuff. And if one adopted that same attitude, you'd be reinventing the wheel every day, wouldn't you?
Mm.
And for a group of highly intelligent people... By the way, Mr. Jian, we're not sure we should employ you because your academic qualifications aren't up to scratch. There were some things that BAS headquarters did that wasn't very bright.
What were your relationships with BAS headquarters like anyway? You were in Halley for 2 years. Did you see anybody from HQ?
Not in the 2 years. In the year before we did, in my second year at Halley, we saw someone. headquarters meant nothing to me. I mean, come on, we were living our own isolated life. I had occasional communications from Sir Vivian Fox, or from the from Sir Edwin Arrowsmith, the governor of the Falkland Islands. What was his title? High Commander, British Antarctic Territory. Hey, what a title. A great guy, actually. And they would communicate quite often in naval code. And what? Yeah, it was great. One of the things as base leader, the first thing you had, well, the outgoing base leader would hand the code book to you, which is kept in a safe, and showed you how to use it. And you waited for your first message to come in code. great stuff.
This isn't a one-time pad. This is something more complex.
Yes, it is.
A one-time pad.
Yes.
So you had to make sure you had the right one time, didn't you?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. You say that Halley Bay has not been visited by headquarters officers for 3 years.
Oh, I said that, right. Yes, it was the fourth year that I was going back for.
And you go on to underline that it was not useful in trying to generate a sense of pride. For a wintering party to be successful, they must feel a sense of pride in their base.
Yeah.
This has been difficult to instill. Was that simply because nobody seemed to care from HQ?
You know, I'm guessing, but I think that I was probably influenced by the views of a large number of people. In other words, that was not a specific view.
This is a compendium.
I believe that's the case, and there were probably rumblings, and particularly, I mean, if you read any reports from Halley at that time, over a period of 2 years, we had massive problems with diesel generators to the point where it almost wiped out scientific work. Our diesel mechanic, Barry Cranbull, an Australian, remarkable, wonderful guy, he worked to a point where he just couldn't go any further. And we had to collect a group of people around to help and support him. And we had horrendous problems. And we had little support. A lot of that was because of communication. We would send faxes, don't be silly, telegrams via Morse code to the manufacturers, Meadows, McFarlane Generators, saying, give us some help, this is going wrong, that's going wrong. And about 3 or 4 weeks later, you'd get a message back. And it was clear they had no idea. They'd say, well, pop down the road and get this spare part, or, you know, get a specialist. They had no idea the isolation and the difficulty of doing these things. And I guess we felt that, Basil, they're in their fancy offices in London or wherever they were at the time, and we have these frustrations and difficulties, and we've indented for so-and-so and it hasn't arrived, maybe they haven't got the money, nobody tells you. You can finish up a bit us and them, can't you?
But at that time, Bass was largely run by people who'd been there and done it.
Yep. Well, my close friend Morris Sumner, who left Halley the year before me and went and worked for headquarters, and a totally competent guy, but then maybe the system didn't allow. Hmm. They were civil servants. I mean, I've talked to Morris prior to, after his time at Bass, and it was a highly civil service organisation, and there were some things he couldn't get done.
It's interesting, isn't it, if you've got a slightly untidy house and you've got visitors coming, you will tidy up for them, won't you? And you make that point here that when you had visits from the Argentinian icebreakers, you tidy up the base first.
Yeah.
And that helped to instill pride.
We were very good at tidying. And if you spoke to my wife, one of the things that drives her mad is that I go around the house tidying. Everything has to be straight and tidy for me. And I certainly impose that on Halley. And I know some of the guys used to rib me for it. You know, oh, stop being an old woman. But then I think that ship shape and all that.
And just going back to your previous conversation, unfortunately some people consider it silly to use ropes and harnesses in crevassed areas. It is hoped that they don't have to learn their lesson the hard way.
Yeah.
True. And that's a reference to your chap who was
a bit gung-ho.
There was another kind of machine that you had a go at called the Lancing.
Oh, that was the most wonderful machine. The Lancing.
Is a word wonderful in inverted commas?
Yes, it is. Bunny Fox tells the story that he was doing a lecture tour in Canada, and he had a call at his hotel by a salesman saying, Sir Vivian, if you look out of the window, and he was on the fifth floor, you'll see in the car park below a snow plane. We'd like you to come and look at it. And he said these people badgered him for, I think, over a year, and trying everything. And eventually they bought one, sent it to Halley. And it was it weighed 1,200 weight in old money, which was, you know, a very light sports car, and had an aero engine on the back of, I don't know, probably 300 or 400 brake horsepower. With a propeller. And this thing, I mean, the power to weight ratio was phenomenal. And on the, you know, in theory, you could sit in this thing, run on skis, didn't have any brakes, because there was no means of stopping it. And, you know, if you had the right surface conditions, it would probably do, I don't know, could do 80 miles an hour.
80 miles an hour, no brakes.
That's a theoretical speed. We've ever got anywhere near that. Because the first thing that happens is that, of course, the snow conditions are so much different to Canada, and they would use these as sports planes in Canada, shooting around the place. You know,
an amphibious propeller-driven sledge with up to 6 people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the first problem is that when it's sat on the snow for a while, you can't get it started. You've got to break it free. And ideally, rather like
it ices up to the snow.
Until you get it moving. The same with the dog sledge. You shake it, and then you have to push, and eventually off it goes. Well, if you're sitting in your plane with the aero engine 400 brake horsepower going on behind you, and nothing's happening, so you get out and shake it and try and move it. Be a bit careful, because the next thing is it goes shoom. So it was another of these vehicles that in theory was very attractive. I had great fun with it because I used it in the last year as my run around Halley.
Well, the Rolls Royce.
Yeah, I loved that.
Base BL's Rolls Royce.
That's right.
I've highlighted the number of times the word vibration appears in your report, and there's 4 mentions of the word vibration. Yeah. So I presume vibration was something of a problem, was it?
Yes, it was. You imagine putting an engine on top of a very light aluminium frame. And as there are no rubber mountings to suppress the vibration, because I guess if you did, at minus 40, rubber goes virtually solid. Mm. So it was another machine, rather like the Eliason, that was designed to shake itself apart. And it's pretty easy to make a machine that'll shake itself apart, isn't it?
How was it going uphill?
Pass. You avoid hills. No. Keep it flat.
The vehicle did not take kindly to the slightest uphill gradient.
There we are, yeah.
And sastrugi?
Oh, dreadful. I mean, the bumping and banging and not viable. Not a viable machine.
So it wouldn't cope with sastrugi?
No.
Very disappointing is your summary. Right. So apart from being Sir's runaround, what was the fate of this machine?
I read online some time ago that it finished up being buried, and a group of people dug it up. So, I mean, it'll be 50 years old now.
Rather like a crashed plane.
Yeah, they just abandoned it. They gave up. Gave up on it. And, you know, the idea of this whirring propeller over your head is not very pleasant.
No.
But there we are. It was great fun.
So what, bearing in mind these failures, what did work? What did you rely upon, technically?
Well, the first thing, the greatest strength was the people. And the people worked. And in my 4 years, I've known some characters who found it difficult, actually, to cope with life. And were maybe not able to contribute as much as they one would hope.
Mm.
But generally speaking, the people were the great strength. You get anything to work. You can get anything to work with the right group of people, can't you? And the remarkable thing about FIDS is that whatever happened, whatever broke, you could always fix it. There'd always be a crowd of guys saying, yeah, come on, we're in this together. Quite remarkable, the way in which, you know, people were quite selfless in the way in which...
You'd been a base member for 3 years before you were made base leader.
Yeah.
Did the appointment come as a surprise?
Yeah. Absolute shock.
Shock?
Yes. Yeah. Why should I have thought otherwise? Why would I have thought, hey, I'm the right? You know, in a recent telephone conversation with a colleague of yours, he used the term which quite amused me, or rather I'd not thought of it before. When he said something to the effect, when you left base F to move to Halle Bay, you did that as a career move. That was his words. And I thought, hang on a minute, Bass wasn't a career. I didn't plan out, I'm going to do this job, I'm going to apply for that, I'm going to move, you know, as one would do corporately, moving up the scale or whatever. Mm-hmm. That never occurred. So when Morris came along and said, I'd like you to be, for a start, I was due to go home after 3 years. I was due on the boat with Morris.
So it was a double whammy, was it?
Double, yeah, and about a month before he said, I'd like you to be base leader. I said, I'm going home. He said, I'd like you to stay. What do you think? And I do recall immediately saying, yeah. I didn't hesitate.
So having experienced being a base member for 3 years, and then you were appointed base leader, what was your kind of policy or your approach to the role? Because you had 3 years worth of watching somebody else do it to form an opinion.
I had one piece of advice from Morris. And bear in mind, we were close. We were, you know, close friends, still are. He said some words to the effect, these are a disparate group of people. He wouldn't have used those words, but you'll know what I mean. There are people who are very strong. There are those who are not as strong, some even weak. You must ensure that any issues, problems, disagreements are focused upon you, because you are the strongest person here. And you're the strongest, and that's why you're base commander, base leader. And when you see issues and problems starting, try and focus it on yourself. Try and get people to focus. So if there is an argument and an issue because, I don't know, this isn't right, that isn't right, we shouldn't be doing that, he's not pulling his weight, focus it on me. And I took that advice, and that was the only bit of advice he gave me.
You can become a sin eater, did you?
Yeah, not sin.
Problem eater.
You know, when you life in particularly midwinter is very intense, as you know, anyone going down south will know. It's not a usual way to spend a life. 30 guys, no girls around the place, 120 days of darkness. God, it's cold out there. You know, wow, what are we doing here? And there are times when, I don't know what were in other people's minds, but I can recall some occasions thinking, what the hell am I doing here? It's Saturday night. I could be out with my mates in the pub, you know, going to the dances with the girl. And there were times when you thought, what the hell am I doing? And when the pressures and the tensions started, and it would often happen with a chef, I can recall a Christmas lunch, superb meal that two chefs had prepared. And one of the guys sat down and said, brown sauce, please. And the chef said, no, not today. I spent a lot of time preparing this meal. No brown sauce. I want brown sauce. And you could see there was an issue on Christmas Day. So I don't recall how, but I stepped in quietly and disarmed it. So one was forever looking at these little tensions going on, and you would try and relieve it, try and either keep the people apart or, if need be, get them together and sort it. It was the toughest leadership job I've ever.
Yes, Christmas Day chef must be just about. It's the one day of the year the chef is being relied upon by absolutely everybody.
Absolutely.
No fun.
I mean, you can imagine at home, wouldn't you? Your wife has prepared the Christmas turkey and you say, have you got any tomato sauce, please?
So, I mean, where do you think you'd gathered these people skills from, as we would now call them? Was it just by watching what was going on around you?
God, I've often asked myself that question. I mean, my father was a hell of an influence on me. He was pretty, not a particularly educated man, but he turned out to be a highly successful businessman. He was very good with people. The early years of my life in Guernsey, of course, we were occupied by the German forces. So there was a situation where we were short of food. If anything broke, you had to mend it because you couldn't go and buy it in a shop. And people learnt to be very resilient. And I think part of the reason that I fitted in so almost perfectly with the Bass way of life was that I'd grown up, and my brothers and father, in this way of making do, mending things, inventing things, And I guess that formed part of my, if you like, psyche. But Dad was a very clever businessman. He really was very clever, and he used to talk to me a lot. And I'd like to think that I've gained quite a lot of sort of business acumen, and you know, I've built very successful businesses. And I always think back to that. I got that from my dad. And I guess, you know, people management, leadership, business, it's all out of the same pot, isn't it? You know, really.
It's interesting. As a child, you had an overbearing enemy. They were the Nazis. As a base lead, he had an overbearing enemy. It was called the Antarctic. It was almost like a foreboding presence in both cases, shaping your life.
That's a bit deep, isn't it? Wow. Okay. So the reason I went down south was I thought this will emulate the Nazi
occupation. No. No.
Interesting thought.
Yeah. No, but just a common enemy type.
There's nothing like a common enemy, is there? I understand that there is a Jerseyman on this reunion, and there is, you know, this wonderful
rivalry
between the two islands. But the only time there is no rivalry is when the British government start dealing tough with us, which they do, and totally unfairly. I'm afraid your British government forget that we are self-governing, and Guernsey and Jersey stick together in adversity.
You'd stay an extra year. You've been south for 4 years with a short break. What were your feelings on that final relief, and you knew you were catching that boat home? Were you glad to go?
No. Well, I was glad to go home. But frankly, if I'd have been invited back again, I would have probably done so. Although I knew that it wasn't a good thing. Because I think one can become institutionalised. And I realised that that was the time that I needed to go out and get a real job.
Well, what does a meteorologist who's worked in the Antarctic do for a living?
What, when he's left?
Yeah.
Well, if he's got any sense, he'll do anything other than meteorology. And it's a very interesting job, but, I mean, it pays peanuts.
Yeah. So what was your future career?
I had none. And, in fact, I don't think I was alone in this, but for 3 years when I got back home, I was unemployable. I would go to a job interview and I could talk about my leadership skills, for example. And I can recall one potential employer saying, look, this is a waste of time. You've wasted 3 or 4 years down in Antarctica. This guy who I happen to go to school with, he spent the last 4 years working in my business. He knows all about it. He's of more value than you are.
Right.
And there was no recognition. And when I think of over the decades, the people that I've sent, senior people in my companies, who I've sent away on these very expensive week-long management stretching courses, climbing mountains,
team building
stuff. And we put so much importance on it, don't we? And yet at that time, it was just not recognised. I may as well have said, well, I spent the last 4 years and 5 years in Timbuktu, and they say, well, you're no use to me. So I became self-employed, building houses, renovating, made a bit of money, and then I got into business. And
So, again, what sort of, in your future life, what skills you learned in the Antarctic do you think served you best? What were you drawing upon from your Antarctic experience that helped you in your orthodox life later on?
I guess the most important was that last year in the experience as base commander.
Yeah.
That gave me a confidence. I joined a company, I recall, I out of desperation with one baby and another baby on the way, I went along to this company, Builders Merchants, and I said, have you got a job? So, sorry, the guy said, we have no jobs. However, he said, but I've got 5 minutes. Let's sit down and tell me about you. So I did. He said, come back tomorrow. So I did. And he said, I've found a job for you. And I stated there and then, it was quite a big company. I said, within 5 years, I want to be on the board. And it took me 6, and I was quite disappointed over that, and finished up as chief executive. I'm now chairman of a group of 8 companies throughout the Channel Islands that effectively I built for someone else. I'm not the beneficial owner. It's one of these big family, a family business. They own ships, they own all sorts of stuff. But the most important thing I brought, I think, Okay, I have my own background. I've talked to you about Dad. I've talked to you about the fact that I can do things and fix things. And the important thing is you understand. When you employ someone and you say, I want you to do that, if you have no idea what that entails, they're going to get away with murder, aren't they?
Mm.
Yeah, so one must be able to say, hang on, I could do that, and you ain't doing a very good job of it. No, I think what I learned as base leader was the core of leadership skill. Now, the first thing I did when I was appointed a director, I changed the whole company round, saying the most important things about this company are the people we employ and the customers. And I was looked at around the board tables as if askance. It's not about that. It's about profit. It's about money. The people you employ, if they don't work, you kick them out the door. Customers, there was a mantra around that board table. If customers don't like it, they can be off and go somewhere else. And I took the culture of, what is it? I'm getting down to it now, aren't I? The culture of bases. Yes, you have a base commander who has no authority whatsoever. 30 odd people at Halley Bay, you're the base commander. On the face of it, you have all the authority in the world. You got nothing. Because they turn around to you and say, hey, forget it, mate. There's 30 of us. We think you're useless. That's it, isn't it? You can only persuade, encourage. And I took that to businesses, and I'm still doing it today. We have investors and people. We have all sorts of, throughout all our 8 companies, they have the highest levels of training and customer service. And it's the key, and I learned that. I learned that at Halley Bay.
Hmm. One of my sort of final questions often is, how do you rate the Antarctic in terms of your whole life? And most chaps say, well, it was the best years of my life. But I'm going to suspect that you'll just say it was a stepping stone to the best years of my life.
Yes. Yeah. And this is where I find myself at odds with a number of the people who I will be spending the next 24 hours
with. The reunion. Yeah. Members.
Who are totally, they are living and they have lived that experience throughout their lives. And possibly even to the detriment, well, that's not for me to say, of careers and whatever. That is the most important thing that happened to me in my life and has enabled me to achieve what I have, whatever that is, and what I am today. But the last 40 years, every day has been a new step. And it's 74, I'm still working 4 days a week, not that I have to, doing not only that, all sorts of jobs, and I chair post offices and all sorts of things, because I just love it, you know. But it steps back, it goes right back to that time. But come on, you mustn't spend your life looking back, you know, and I just use that.
So have you ever wanted to go back, as a grown-up, so to speak?
Well, you know, it's often been suggested, why don't we go on a holiday to Antarctica? And I say, no thanks. Because what I gather, and I may be wrong, you're going to go on board a very comfortable ship. If the weather is if the weather's inclement, then you're not going to land anywhere. You're probably going to be around the periphery of you're not going to see the Antarctica that we did. And I don't want a second best, thanks. So I'd rather, let's leave that as a memory. However, somebody yesterday evening said, I have a CD compilation of photographs, and there are quite a few of you. I'm sure you'd like them, so you can look at them and reminisce. And I didn't say anything, and after a while he said, you're not really interested, are you? I said, I'm sorry, not really.
Then why do you come to the reunions, then?
That's a very good question. I don't attend many.
You can't be slightly pregnant, can you?
No. I don't attend many. For a start, it's cost me £500 to get here from Guernsey, which is crazy, isn't it, for a couple of days. Sorry, that's by the by. I'm here because I know I'm going to meet Gordon Barra, Dad, and mainly those two. Might have been Morris. So that's the primary reason. And on this occasion, it was because I was badgered into doing what I'm doing now. And I think somebody said, if you don't do it now, it'll probably be too late. And I thought, okay, I'll do it. When will I attend the next one?
Well, I'm very glad you've done it. Thank you, Dudley.
Thank you. It's been quite a pleasurable experience, actually. Yeah.